Welcome to the Heroic Minds Podcast, where we uncover the heroic stories of individuals overcoming illness, battling through adversity, and rising to the top of professional sport, business, and life. Conversations that reveal the principles to become the hero of your own story. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Heroic Minds. Today's episode is a story where it was actually two instances of adversity delivered at once. The first thing that came to mind was how in control they were of their emotions. And I think that was the key to how triumphant they've been in overcoming their obstacles and why they are thriving today. And our guest today is Brett McLean. His background is that he achieved his dream. And he was in, really, he was just at the beginning of a journey in professional sports. And that is right when tragedy struck. And he didn't let it slow him down at all. Really excited. I'll try not to be a super fan about this one. Although I do look up to a lot of hockey players. And Brett was definitely one of them. As I was climbing up the ranks of hockey myself, he was someone in the Ontario Hockey League that I looked up to. So, Brett, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
To go back as a young child, I think, is where we'll start, and then we'll fast forward to the story and what you went through and how you got through it, and then again, how you carry yourself with such control today. So growing up, was hockey everything? Was that the goal?
Yeah, big time. I mean, I'm from a small town, Port Elgin, Ontario. When I was growing up, no kids from there had ever made the NHL, and I just loved hockey. Every Saturday night, I'd watch it on TV, you know, see the coach's corner and just watch the guys, watch the Leafs, watch the Canadians and say, I want to do that. And then I'd watch my dad play men's league and think, oh, he's pretty good. I want to be as good as him someday. And then, you know, start playing and had some success. But for me, I just loved the game. I'd play, you know, it's the true story of go home from school and go on the outdoor rink and play until dinner and then go in and eat and then go back out until it was bedtime. And, you know, it's funny, growing up, I would say to everyone, I'm going to play in the NHL, and people are like, you're not going to play in the NHL. You're from Port Elgin, no one plays in the NHL, or kids would be like, oh, you're so cocky, you think you're going to play in the NHL, but it was just, that's all I wanted to do. And actually, one funny story, I was in fourth grade, and we had to pick what we wanted to do when we grew up, and so we're sitting there, and I'm like, I want to put hockey player, but I was embarrassed to put it because I thought people were going to make fun of me. So I copied my buddy and said, I want to be a firefighter because that's what he put. Like, but it was because I had no, nothing else. It was just hockey forever. And, you know, luckily for me, you know, it worked out and I got that opportunity. But, yeah, it was the only thing I ever wanted to do.
And even though hockey was everything, the way you're telling it, it seems like it was from a simple approach, though. I know you thought you were going to be an NHL hockey player one day, but you played the game without any stress. It seems like you went out on the rink. You didn't put pressure on yourself that I got to do this and this and this from a young age, or did you put the pressure on yourself?
No, I mean, the only pressure I put on myself is, especially when I was younger playing in Port Elgin, I was a bad loser and I always wanted to win, and I knew I was the best player on my team, so if we lost, I felt like it was my fault. So the pressure came from wanting to win every night. It was never, I need to score more than this guy or I need to be better than this person. It was just that I need to win, so I need to do whatever it takes to make my team win. And if I had 3 goals and we lost, I was still mad because we lost the game. I thought I should have had 4 or 5. So that was kind of, for me growing up, probably was hard to be on my team sometimes because we'd think we played well and I'd be annoyed more at myself that we didn't win. And I know I drove my parents nuts quite a bit with that, but and it was just, that's all it was a burning desire to win, and I loved hockey and just wanted to play as much as I could.
That's such a, to me, healthy approach from what being in the hockey world today and yourself being in the hockey world today, the approach that it's just so much pressure on these young kids, but in a very personal way where it's self-fulfillment or self, gaining for personal reasons and to get the points for yourself so that you can move on and you can do your careers better. But I've never heard it that way from a player that, I guess a side note for listeners, Brett was a skill player to say the least. Look at his statistics online, has numbers that, you know, most players in the NHL had in junior hockey, and if not, he had even more. And for a player like that to have the approach you did is, I find, very rare. Let's take the next step in the story. So you have this approach where it's the team first, and desire, a burning desire to always win as a team. And that's starting to work in your favor as a player. Things are starting to work out where, you know what, that being on the outdoor rink saying I'm going to play in the NHL one day is actually not that far away now. And you're drafted and in the Ontario Hockey League, and the next step may be the NHL. So what's now, what's your mindset? Is it the same thing?
It kind of switched. I mean, I got drafted by Erie, first round pick, and you know, you think things are going to go great, and played there, and I did okay. Like, I had 23 points my first year, and halfway through the second year, I had 8 points in 13 games. I've been injured for a bit, and then, you know, you're kind of like, well, I'm doing okay, but, like, you see other guys being more successful, or you see the top guys getting drafted, and I think at that point, I was like, well, maybe I won't make it, like, I want to, but things, you know, I wasn't having the success that some other, you know, high-end picks were having or whatever, and then I got traded to Oshawa, and it was kind of like a reset on my career, and from that moment, it kind of took off. I finished the rest of that year with over a point a game, and then, you know, had 200-point seasons there and played with some great players like John Tavares and Kyle Clutterbuck. And I think just for me, that change and reset was huge in my career. I think I enjoyed my time in Erie, but I don't think I was up to my potential. I think that was, you know, on myself. I don't know if I just kind of got in like a lull where things weren't going well, and you kind of get in that cycle where, oh, well, I'm not doing well, and then I don't play well, and then not right. doing what I thought I would, and then you go somewhere else, get a new opportunity, and things kind of clicked from the minute I got there, and it completely changed.
So then change was good at that point. Mm-hmm. So that's your first instance, I guess, in your career where not drastic change, but pretty big change took place, and you were able to find a way to utilize that and be triumphant through it, which is, I guess, also leading into where we're going with this. So you get to that point, you're with the Oshawa Generals, and you are a an NHL draft pick to the Phoenix Coyotes. And from there, take us right to where, you know, right before tragedy struck. What was your mindset? Where were things going? Because I know, again, referencing back to the people I met with, you were looked at by a bunch of teams and people in the hockey world that this guy is just a matter of time. This year, next year, he's going to make the jump to stay in the National Hockey League. I know you had some games beforehand, as all young NHL players do coming up. You know, they'll have some games in the NHL, they'll have some games in the American League, and then there'll be a time where they stick in the NHL. They get that long-term deal and they're able to stay. You weren't far off from that, and all signs were pointing that that's where you're about to go. So let's catch up to that point, and then we'll get into where things really get real.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I think my pro career was kind of twofold. I started off in San Antonio in the American League. I signed my pro deal, and you know, after my success in the OHL, it's funny. You play in the OHL and you're a scorer, and you don't get relied on so much for defense. And I don't think I really learned how to play. So my first year was completely learning how to play pro hockey. You know, I did pretty well. I got to play in the American League All-Star game that year and everything. But that year, wasn't ready for the NHL. I didn't know how to play D, and I was very lucky that I had great coaching staff in Greg Ireland and Ray Edwards, and they taught me kind of how to play D. And then my second year, I went into training camp, had a great camp with Phoenix, thought I was going to stick with the team, and the last day I got cut. And they actually sent down Kyle Turris and Mikkel Bodker, and we had a good young team in San Antonio. I ended up leading the team in points, so outscoring those guys. And that was kind of my moment where, like, all right, I think I'm ready.
The background is there. You grew up on a backyard rink every night playing, thinking you were going to get to the NHL and play in the NHL. You went through a similar journey to many other people. You get to the NHL. You know, you like you just said, you had your time in the American League. You developed. You felt the next step was going to be the NHL. And you here you are in the summer of
2012.
And I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah, just got home for the summer. You know, it was kind of a frustrating year. That's probably the first year that I was frustrated. Got picked up on waivers by Winnipeg, played 5 games at the start of the year. You know, didn't really feel like I had a great opportunity there to show what I could do, and went back to Phoenix and played in the American League, had a good year, was AHL Player of the Month in December, and never got called up with them. They were still, you know, happy with me, had good conversation with them, but was kind of at a point where I was debating, like, am I going to leave and go to the KHL for a year, or am I going to get traded so I can try with another team, kind of what happened to the OHL, the restart. And so I think my life was pretty stressful actually at the time. So it was July 2nd. I was back home and I was going to go skate in Owen Sound for my first skate of the summer. And went out, with my, you know, we had a hockey group there of guys that played junior and pro from the area that I'd been skating with for years. And 40 minutes in the skate, come down the ice and make a pass. And I guess, like, I don't remember any of it, but I guess kind of leaned against the boards and all of a sudden just slid down the boards. And at first the guys kind of thought I was joking around because his first skate, always pretending he's tired. And luckily for me, two of the guys I play with realized something was wrong. Started CPR, and you know, it's kind of like right time, right place. One of my buddies that I skate with, his dad's a firefighter, and he was there watching, and he knew that they needed to grab the AED, the automated external defibrillator, and came out on the ice, called 911, and he started shocking me, and paramedics were there in 7 minutes, which is amazing, and got me to the hospital, and that was kind of the beginning of it.
Wow. So there was someone trained in first aid that was there, and do we know because doing my research, the odds of survival in that specific situation are not
5%.
5%. Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's obviously low. And at the time you don't know much about.
No, I the first two guys started CPR, and
are you awake at this point?
No idea. The only thing I remember from this entire thing, and I don't know if it was when I got airlifted to London or if I was in the ambulance going to Owen Sound. I think it was going to the ambulance to Owen Sound, the paramedic talking to me and like squeezing her finger. Like she was like, if you can hear me, squeeze my finger. And I did. And she was talking. And then, cause I met her, a couple months later, I went to a game, attack game, and they honored the people that saved me. And she was there, and she said, do you remember talking to me? And I did. That was the only thing I remember at all between that time and getting airlifted to London.
Wow. So you don't remember anything really that happened once you made that pass, but you remember making that pass?
I don't even remember going to the rink. And actually, so they put me in a medically induced coma to kind of try and preserve brain function and everything. And they wouldn't know for 2 days until I came out of it. When I came out of it, my mom was there and obviously had no idea what's going on. And she asked me if I knew what happened. And I said, I think I drowned, because I went to the beach that day and that was the last thing I remember. She said, you didn't drown. I said, oh, well, is my truck okay? And she goes, yeah, why wouldn't it be? Because I was like, well, if that didn't happen, I must have gotten a car accident. And then, so she's like, you're playing hockey. I had no idea that, I didn't remember even going to the rink or that was what I was doing that day.
Wow. I hear, that's incredible. So going back to on the ice, before we get into the ambulance, you said two guys came over to help you, and did that, the father of one of your buddies came over and started.
He grabbed the paddles
and
started that. And so I think they had that on me within 3 minutes. So pretty quick, because how it works is for every minute that you don't get CPR or use of an AED, your chance of living drops 10%. So that's why they kind of say within 7 minutes you need, you know, CPR and the paddles, or else you're in real tough shape, because you're already at 70% chance of not surviving.
Wow.
So they were doing that quick, and I think they had to shock me two or three times, and then the ambulance was there within 7 minutes. And I don't know if they had to do it again or not, but luckily between the group of them, they saved me. So very lucky that, I guess, you know, obviously it's something you never want to happen to you, but if you're going to be anywhere in a public place, I guess an arena in Ontario is probably the best place to be, especially if there's people that know what they're doing.
Right, right. Wow. And you talk about that so easily. When going to the hospital room, when you come to, because hearing you speak sounds so similar to when I woke up in the hospital and I was in induced coma as well, and you're trying to piece together a puzzle that doesn't exist. And how do you, as much as you remember, come to understanding at that point when you're having a conversation with your mother, you were saying? Mm-hmm. And so what was the thought right there? Was it life? Was it hockey? Was there worry?
At the beginning, it was obviously life, worrying about being alive. But I know that, like, now I'm very content with where I'm at. But at the moment, like, I guess I asked my mom, am I going to be able to play hockey again? And she said, no. And I said, well, why did they save me? Because you're just kind of like, in that moment, you know, everything I've worked for is gone, and it's not fair why it happened to me. And, you know, you're just so frustrated. And obviously at that moment, you're not thinking about, you know, there's so much more to life than just hockey. But at that moment, I was very, you know, very upset. And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And I think I knew from the beginning that there was no way I was going to play, but I was secretly hoping that one doctor, like, talk to the NHLPA doctor, talk to the Coyotes doctor. I think my agent got another outside doctor, and then the doctor there, and you're hoping one of them will say, well, maybe there's a chance, but all of them is pretty easy no. So, you know, you're kind of, first of all, you're trying to recover and move on with life. Like, you first wake up and you can't even walk to the shower because you're so exhausted. So you're dealing with that, and then you're also realizing that your whole life is going to change is pretty tough.
So before we get into that, because I want to dive into that for sure, what exactly happened? Were there any clues beforehand that would have led to that? What exactly was the injury that occurred to the heart?
So I suffered a cardiac arrest. So that's basically what happens is the heart stops beating. And the way they explained it to me is with heart issues, you can either have there's two types of problems. There's like a plumbing problem and an electrical problem. So mine was electrical. Plumbing usually involves more like heart attacks where there's like a blockage or there's something wrong with the pumping. The electrical is more of the cardiac arrest. So it's how it works is when your heart beats, there's kind of two pulses. And for whatever reason, when my heart rate elevated that day, the pulses kind of got out of whack and it threw my heart into a regular rhythm and then it stopped. So it started beating abnormally and then all of a sudden it just stopped beating at all. And then the blood flow obviously stops and you're in trouble. So at first they thought I had this genetic syndrome called long QT syndrome. I've done, I don't even know how many tests now to see if they could find out a reason why it happened. And they don't have an answer. All they know is I probably have something genetic that hasn't been found yet. So I thought I had long QT syndrome. And then I did more genetic testing and they came back and said, we know you don't have this, but we don't know what you have. Wow. So I'm at a point now where I don't know what it is. To be honest, I don't really care anymore. Like, it'd be nice to know, but, you know, I'm on a beta blocker to slow my heart down. And since I've been on that, I haven't had any issues. And, I mean, as long as I don't have issues and I can live my life day to day, I'm not overly concerned with what the final diagnosis is. It is what it is, and just kind of move on.
So then you now can live a regular life, but there's just no label on exactly what it is. So you can't go to, you know, your family and say, this is what I have, or it's, but you know, so at this point things are stable though, and you can now pursue everyday things.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the one thing they told me is, you know, the one good thing is I had no damage to my heart. So they're like, you're going to be able to run, you're going to be able to play sports, you're going to be able to do kind of what everyone else that is your age does. The only problem is you can't be a professional athlete anymore. And a lot of that is because they had to put an implanted cardiac defibrillator in my chest. So basically what happens is because I had a cardiac arrest, I'm more susceptible to having it again than, say, you or any normal person. So this is kind of like a safety net. So they're like, now you can go do stuff and you don't have to worry because you've already got something that can shock you if it happens. But because of that, I can't play contact sports because if the wires break, then it's useless. So it's more the contact. Like, I'll still elevate my heart rate and, you know, go for runs, play sports. I play pickup hockey. I play, you know, with a lot of ex-junior and pro guys. So it's still at a good pace. Obviously not the same level as that. But it's, I don't ever worry about, I don't want to get my heart rate up or I don't want to do that.
So there's no threshold then of where you're,
Or at least I haven't found one.
Yeah.
So either I'm not pushing myself hard enough or I'm in pretty good shape.
Pretty good.
So,
we'll go with that. Yeah. You're just in too good a shape Wow. So now I guess we can get into now things are stable in the hospital. You have an understanding of what's going on. And I know at first you said, you know, then why did they save me if I'm not going to be able to play hockey, which I'm sure was a first reaction when emotions were high and there were frustrations and questions. So leaving the hospital, did that mindset start to change? Now, how did you, because one of the articles I read about your story said that even in the hospital, you started to have this positive aura of accepting what was and then realizing there was help to be provided to others that may go through the same situation.
Yeah, I think for me the biggest thing was I didn't want this to be the defining moment in my life, or, you know, there's the guy that was close to, you know, being a full-time NHL player and then had heart issues, and then we never heard from him again, or he became a grumpy old bitter person. And I kind of thought the best way to make what happened to me into a positive was to try and help other people. And obviously, because of my story and being a professional athlete and being a young guy and having a little bit of success, I could reach more people with my story than, say, an 80-year-old elderly man could with his story. And I think the biggest thing I wanted to get through to people was not that they should be scared of heart problems, but heart disease affects everybody, and it can happen to you at 20 years old. And you need to be aware of that and take the precautions to make sure you're okay. And on the flip side of that is you should enjoy your life every day, because you never really know when something's going to happen. I mean, my biggest concern at that time was, where am I going to play hockey next year and how much money am I going to make? And at the time I was very stressed about it, but now looking back, like, you're kind of like, that's pretty small things to worry about. At the time I knew I was going to play hockey somewhere, and I knew that I was still playing professional, and you know, you're kind of like, life's pretty good when you think about it, where, you know, you don't have worries about what are you going to eat tonight, what are you going to do. It's okay, I got to get up tomorrow and work out, and then I got to figure out where I'm going to play. So I think that put a lot in perspective of, you know, life can be a lot worse than that. And I just wanted to try and find a way to help other people and kind of shed light on what happened to me. And, you know, I think being able to do a lot of things is a great story to tell, because then if someone, you know, it happens to a young person now, they can look and be like, oh, Brett McLean, 6 years ago, and he's still out being active and doing things and living a normal life.
Mm-hmm. And still tearing up the 3-on-3 league that you're playing. Trying to. I've heard good things about your performance in that league. Little shout out to the 3-on-3 league, 3HL, that Brett plays in Toronto or all over Ontario?
It's all over Ontario. I play for the Guelph Brewers. It's good. We got a good group of Waterloo guys. We won a tournament last weekend in Owen Sound. So, yeah, the Guelph Brewers are hot this year.
So, yeah, get out to watch a game, watch this guy perform. You can see the skill work that I was talking about. So, continuing on here, I as you were telling that portion, I started to smile, because I feel a lot of athletes and individuals, especially nowadays, we all get caught up in the money and all get caught up in how we look on Instagram and social media. And the way you told that was so genuine, that there's so many other things. And I know it's something that people always talk about. It's like, oh, well, don't worry, you know, things could always be worse. But often you have to hear it from someone or go through it to really realize, because people say it all the time. And now it's just almost a cliche. And you're like, yeah, whatever. I know things could be worse. But to hear that from you and then filling that, those new feelings and realizations with the way I'm going to get through this is helping other people. Going back, that's why I started the story with you evolving as a hockey player and how you approach the game. Did that mindset of that fire to want to win and succeed as a group have any influence on your approach what you just talked about, your approach to, I'm going to get through this and empower myself by helping other people?
Not really. I think, to be honest, if I look back on my career, like, even though it might have helped me, I think I stressed way too much on individual games. You know, I'd go home and overanalyze missed opportunities and whatever because I wanted to win every single game. And like, now looking back, probably be like, who cares? Just one game and go on to the next one and move on with my life. But I think outside of that, yeah, definitely just, okay, what am I, my life was always, you know, what am I going to do next to get better? What am I going to do to help my team win? What am I going to do to be a better player? What am I going to do to get there? And then after this, it was kind of like, okay, what am I going to do now with my life to better my life and do something else? And what's the next approach? I mean, I went from leaving the hospital and I have no idea what I'm going to do to being like, okay, I'm going to go back to university and figure out where I wanted to go. And really, I ended up at the University of Waterloo because my brother was at Laurier and I wanted to be close to him. And that was it. I knew nothing about school because I hadn't really explored it since 18, but I was like, okay, now it's time to kind of think about that step. And I mean, I've been very lucky with how things have fallen into place. Went to the University of Waterloo and Brian Bork offered me the assistant coaching job at the hockey team so I could stay in hockey, and did some stuff with heart and stroke, met some people through that have helped me, you know, further my career outside of school, getting a job for Canadian Tire in their corporate office for a year, and then you know, meeting people and ending up at the Hill Academy as a general manager. So, I mean, the things that have happened to me have all kind of fallen in a place to get me to where I am. And I think a lot of it is just having a positive outlook. If I was very negative after that, nobody would want to help me. So I think the attitude is really of just kind of being, okay, now it's time to move on to what's next. And just trying to be a nice person has really helped me getting to where I am now.
Going off that, I'm gonna throw a tough question at you. And I know I sent you a couple rough ideas of what we were going to discuss here today. And because again, you are in such control of the situation, it seems like from right away, you know, you had your time in the hospital to, you know, question and then you found answers and thought you were are helping a ton of people. Like that was the plan. And you're doing so with Heart and Stroke Foundation and with sharing your story. When you watch hockey, is there any type of not remorse, frustration or anything like that that comes to mind? And how do you deal with that? Because I know is an issue that, and you would know as well, players that have to move on from playing, whether on their own accord or not, people that have to move on from a job they didn't decide to, people that don't finish schooling and it's maybe not, you know, they were obligated into it. And there's, how do you deal with that part of it? Because people, not just in hockey, we all deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you approach that situation, because that's what I'm so amazed by you, is that you were there, and everyone that knows you and everyone in the hockey world said he would have been a player. He would have been in the National Hockey League. How do you come to terms with that in such a positive way, in such a controlled, composed way?
Well, even that, like, lined up perfectly for me. The year that happened, the lockout was the first half of the year. So I went from September to January, there was no hockey. So I kind of had some time to recover and figure out what my next steps were going to be before they even started playing. Where I think if that didn't happen, maybe it would have been hard, because I would have been sitting at my parents' house in Port Elgin with no plan and no idea what I'm going to do, and all my friends are back playing hockey. So, I mean, even things like that, small detail, really helped in my recovery. And then, you know, to be honest, it was hard for a little while watching, you know, your buddies go and they're playing and they're having success and they're playing in the NHL. And I still, you know, I miss the competitive part of it, and I miss going on the ice and competing and trying to win. And I miss the rush of scoring goals, and I don't know if that'll ever completely be gone. But I enjoy going to watch hockey now or whatever, and I don't sit there and feel bitter that I'm not playing or that could have been me still or I didn't get enough time with it. I'm back to kind of being a fan. And, you know, obviously, like anyone that played, you have your moments where I wish I was still playing, it'd be so cool to score that goal or whatever. But it just, I think as my life evolved and I started doing different things, you become content with what you're doing, and you're so focused on what you're going to do next that you don't really have time to sit there and say, oh, this is poor me, I don't get to play the NHL.
Right. And so easy to say, because I know that is such a tough situation, but I guess like you said, you were obligated because of the lockout, you know, that everyone was separating themselves from the game, really. There was no hockey to watch, so you separate yourself from the game, you put together a plan of moving forward, and then it sounds like you accepted the situation. Yeah, I'll always probably miss it. I'll miss, you know what, we all wish we could be on vacation, we can't. Mm-hmm. We all wish we could play in the NHL, we can't, and accept that situation, which is easier said than done. But did you talk about it with people? Was it never really an issue that you needed to speak on with anyone?
No, you know what? I probably, my first year after it happened, I was very, you know, positive all the time. I'm so lucky to be alive and everything's great. And I think about halfway through my second year, kind of, I was feeling better and I was starting to settle in, and I think got through a point where I was very frustrated and angry. And, you know, I think I hadn't had time to, like, let out my frustrations on it. And I had always kind of bottled in and, like, oh, I'm going to be positive because people are asking me how it is and I want to put on a good face and mm-hmm. say everything's great. And I remember one night, went out with a couple of my buddies at home and came back, and I was at my parents in Port Elgin, and just kind of, like, got home and started crying to my parents about, you know, I'm sick of everyone saying you're so lucky to be alive, because I'm like, it's not fair. Like, I didn't do anything wrong to not get to play hockey, and then my whole life has to change, and that I have to worry about heart problems and all this stuff. And I was like, I'm sick of everyone saying you're so lucky, because I'm lucky to be alive, but I'm not lucky that this happened to me. And kind of probably vented to them for about 2 hours. And luckily for me, have great parents that listened to me. And kind of helped me through it. And I was almost like the next day I woke up and I was like, okay, you know what? I've had my time to tell everyone that this is garbage and I'm not happy about it. And I moved on. It was like at that moment, like the 2 or 3 months of frustration and built up anger that I probably kept inside because I was telling people, oh, I'm so lucky and everything. It was just like lifted off my shoulders. And I ever since then, I haven't really had any issues. And I've kind of just moved forward from that moment and been, it's almost like that was my weak point. And now I've been building up since and I don't have any of those feelings anymore. So it was good to get it out, I guess.
That's awesome. I joke around with my girlfriend actually when I this year when things happen that we're not comfortable with, we're frustrated with, things built up and everything's relative, right? So one issue for someone is bigger than for someone else, and we always joke about the 24-hour rule where you're just so frustrated you don't even feel like talking and you have your 24 to vent and get it out of your system and be upset and, you know, march around the house and put your headphones on, not listen to anyone. You have your 24 hours and then you share what you need to, and then you find, you like you just said, you separate yourself for a little bit, you implement a plan and then move forward, which sounds similar to what you're saying. Is you have this built up anger, frustration, whatever it is, you get it out of your system to someone that you trust, and then really there's nowhere to go but up, which is what it seems like was the plan for you, which is, I think, is absolutely awesome. So that's cool. A good message for people. And if there's anyone, any listeners, or if you know of anyone, I always say this when I speak, and it seems like Brett would be in the same boat. If there's anyone you know or you personally are having trouble with moving on from something or sport or need to vent on something, my contact is on the website. So always feel free to reach out. That's what this Heroic Minds thing is all about. For anyone along this path, whether before hockey or after hockey, I enjoy having this conversation with people because I obviously have my idols and I love to hear idols that other people have and why. And I wondered if you had any idols before your adversity and after, if anything has changed or why you look up to certain people that have helped you along the way.
I mean, for me, like, where I grew up, Mario Lemieux was my favorite player, and obviously I liked him because of how great a player he was, and I thought he was the most skilled player of all time. But as I got older, you start to look at all the things that he kind of battled through in his career, like back injuries, cancer, and he just kind of figured ways to roll through that and was, you know, obviously for him, hockey kind of stayed as what he could do, but he just came back better than before every time when he could have let those things impact him and negatively affect the rest of his life. And, you know, it's shows the kind of person he was. And so I think always was him that I looked up to as a player. And then after, you kind of can draw on what he went through and take that as motivation.
That's awesome. Do you think then, like you just said, he actually came, Marlon Mew, relating to him, he came back better, and yes, he was lucky enough to play hockey, but hockey aside, he came back better through injury. And do you think, whether it be mentally, socially, in any way, that your experience made you better, or there's something that you learned or realized? I mean, obviously there is, as the things we've talked about today, but specifically, is there something that really changed you that day, or the day that you vented and were frustrated, was there something that you realized that has now made you that much more unstoppable or better today than you were back then?
Honestly, I think it's, you know, it's corny because everyone says it, but I think just the perspective of enjoying life every day. I don't really sweat small stuff. My girlfriend always say, I wish that I could be more like you. She'll come home from work all frustrated. I come home from work, and even if I have a bad day, I'm like, whatever, I'll go watch TV now, and life moves on. And I think just that going through that, things that are minor, they kind of roll off me a lot easier, and I can stay focused on what I'm doing, and I don't spend a lot of wasted time on minor details that don't really matter anymore. So I think that's the biggest thing, is my day is kind of built around things that are important to me and things that make me happy, and those negative moments or whatever are just kind of minor blips in the radar, and that's it.
That's cool. You build a day around things that make you happy. I think that's something for people to keep in mind. So that being your mindset, is there, and I know we briefly touched on it, but is there any fear of death? And I know that's a very loaded question. I come off and it's so blunt, but is there any fear of Because people always ask me that with my head injury. Is there a fear that you'll get another head injury when I was playing, or is there a fear of anything else? And you know what? For me, that kind of floats around and lingers with all the research that you keep. I mean, my Twitter's full of it because of the people that I follow, and it's all this research coming out. And I'm sure you have similar situation where you're involved in the Heart and Stroke Foundation, and some research is positive, some's negative. Does that whole idea ever float around your head, or is there a way you deal with that, or is it just not an issue?
When I went right after, for the first probably year and a half or so, I would get panicked. I had anxiety sometimes going out in public because I'm like, I don't want this to happen in public and everyone's going to see me collapse and whatever, or there'd be times when I would be a little nervous. And just kind of as I've battled through that, and you know, with talking to people and just kind of as every day going through the day and nothing happens and move on to the next day, I've kind of moved past that to the point now where I don't think about it any more than probably anyone else would. I mean, obviously, if I was going to jump off a mountain, I'd probably be like, well, I might die here. But I don't walk down the street anymore thinking something's going to happen to me or anything like that. I just kind of go on with my life and don't think about it. And it's just the same as anyone else. I'm just going to go do what I like to do and have fun doing it. And that's what I do.
So you're more scared about embarrassing yourself by collapsing in public than you are of actually the detriment that actually
the big
happening.
Thing for me was I would look like an idiot if I collapse and people would be staring at me. That was more my concern than actually dying, which kind of sounds stupid, but that was it. It was, right. I don't want to be somewhere and something happen and all these people are looking at me.
Right. That's, well, that's a healthy way to deal with it, I think. So before we get on to some little bit about hockey, the controversy or hot topics in hockey these days, which I'm excited to get into, what is it that you're doing now for Heart and Stroke? And I'm going to hand this over to you to talk about whatever you'd like, because I know you do a lot of work with them, and you can share the ride this summer that's happening in Toronto to see if we can draft some participants from this podcast. But yeah, so what is it that you're how do you help out now? Because I know you do a lot.
So I've been a spokesperson for them pretty much since day one after the accident. And you know, I just kind of been going around telling my story at different heart and stroke events, raising awareness and just kind of trying to get the word out about, you know, the importance of knowing how to do CPR and having AEDs in public places and people knowing how to use them. And really the big thing about an AED is it's idiot proof. It won't shock someone if they don't need it. So you know, even if you don't really know what you're doing, it talks to you and tells you what to do. So my big thing with that is, you know, anyone can use it and you can't do any harm. If someone's already in a cardiac arrest and you put that on, though, you can't make them more dead. So as blunt as that
that's
is,
perfect.
Right?
It's, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, getting people confident to use them because they can save lives. And the big thing I do for them is what we talked about, the Heart and Stroke Run, Walk, and Ride for Heart. It's on June 3rd this year in Toronto. I've been doing it for 5 years now. It's a really cool experience. You get to either bike 25, 50, or 75 kilometers along the Gardner and the Don Valley Parkway, or you can run, I think it's up to 10 kilometers along the Gardner, and just a really cool way to see the city of Toronto. I think everyone that's out there knows driving to Toronto can be a nightmare, and it's pretty cool to bike at basically the same speed you're moving through rush hour and see all the buildings and see the entire city, and you get to see it, you know, going west to east and then back east to west, and it's just an awesome experience, and it's a really fun day, and more important than that, you're raising awareness and funds for heart and stroke research that goes a long way in helping save lives.
Cool. And we're all chasing you, right? You're leading it. Yeah. And if anyone beats you, they get a grand prize of something, right?
Yeah. Because I go pretty quick out of the gate on that. So.
I'm just kidding. That's not true. So don't start training to try and beat Brett in the ride. But I'm going to provide a link for that on the description. So check that out. I'm already signed up. I'm going to be doing that ride with a buddy. And I'm sure I'll run into Brett there as well. To conclude here, to sum things up, knowing now that you had a 5% chance of survival and you totally being the hero of your own story today, how do you take that into consideration every day, knowing that those were the chances and that you've done so well and overcome so much?
I think for me, like, I look at it two ways. I look at, I was in the right place at the right time with people there that knew what they were doing. And that was a big part of why I'm still here. But the other part of it was, you know, being a professional athlete and being in such great shape, like they've told me that that's a huge reason why I'm still alive too. So I look at it like I was, you know, I put myself in the best position to survive by the life that I was living and, you know, being in great shape and eating well and taking care of my body. But then obviously I needed that outside factor that people there knew CPR and how to use an AED. So, you know, I think that that's, it kind of ties into life, right? Like for everyone to be successful, you need to be in the right place at the right time with opportunity, but it's really what you do with it and kind of how you set yourself up for success or failure that kind of prepares you for those opportunities. I mean, people that do everything they can to get themselves in the right opportunities usually find the right opportunities. And, you know, there's very few people I find in this world that do everything right and just don't get any luck. And there's very few people that do nothing and get a lot of luck. So I think it's a bit of both. And that's kind of what happened to me in that day. And that's kind of what I've taken from it into my life, that if you work hard and prepare yourself, usually you're going to put yourself in a spot where success is going to follow you. And it's when you stop doing that then you guys start worrying.
That's awesome. That is the perfect conclusion. I love when things, I don't know what to say. And you just did that. You put yourself in the best position because failure's going to happen. And for some, failures is bigger for some and smaller for others. Again, everything's relative, but if you put yourself in the best position to deal with failure, you're at the same time putting yourself in the best position to be successful, because it's succeeding through failure is really what we continually do. That's perfect. Bingo. I think we're good. Check out Brett's social media, Twitter, Instagram. Twitter and Instagram.
Instagram, yeah.
All right, so Twitter and Instagram. So if you'd like to reach out to him regarding his story, his journey, if, again, you are in a similar situation with moving on from hockey or pursuing other goals and you want a little bit of support, reach out. You can reach out to myself as well. Also, look into the Heart and Stroke Ride for Heart on June 3rd. And I will be there. I will not be leading the charge, but I'll be there somewhere on the ride.
Middle of the pack.
Yeah, middle of the pack. Brett, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to try something new to finish this episode. If you want to tag Brett or myself and the Heart and Stroke Foundation on Twitter or Instagram, which I will provide in the description, if you share that, I will send you a Heroic Minds t-shirt. There's new ones online, and I'll ship that to your house. So if you want to put together a tweet or Instagram, there'll be one winner after this episode is posted. And thanks for listening. I have some more exciting guests coming up soon. So subscribe and keep being the hero of your own journey. Thanks.